Big news! This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which flight deals are actually deals and which are clickbait. They'll also tell you when to skip the bundle and book separately. Plus, how to avoid paying for upgrades that you won't use. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Frommer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Frommer. You know, usually on this show, we have guests who will come on and talk about one destination or maybe two destinations. But my next guest has circumnavigated the entire damn world and wrote about it in a beautiful book. It's called The Size of the World, Once Around Without Leaving the Ground. His name is Jeff Greenwald. Hey, Jeff, thank you so much for coming back to the Frommer Travel Show.
Hi, Pauline. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, well, always great to see you. And this is a book that you wrote 30 years ago. It's now been reissued in the 30th anniversary edition. Take me back 30 years ago or 31 years ago. How did you decide to do this crazy thing?
Well, the book, the 30th anniversary edition, actually dates back to the first publication, which was in 1995. The trip itself that the book describes was taken in 1993-94. I was going to turn 40 years old in March of 1994, and I wanted to do something really meaningful for that birthday. I spent a lot of time in Nepal and India and Sri Lanka and these Buddhist and Hindu countries, and I decided to do what's called a kora, a devotional circumambulation, usually done clockwise, around a holy shrine or mountain or so forth. I decided to look at the earth as my holy object and to do a land and sea circumambulation of the globe, starting off from Oakland, California, walking out of my flat with my backpack on and coming back, however long it took later, having proved to myself that the world was round and having this devotional kora practice.
But you could have done some of that in the air, and you still would have been circumnavigating the globe in a clockwise manner. Was it eco reasons? Were you worried about green travel 30 years ago? Is that why you decided to do this, sticking closer to the ground?
No, the reason I decided to stick closer to the ground is really because I wanted the visceral experience of the size of the world, which is kind of where the book gets its name. I'd been travel writing at that point for quite a few years, and I'd been flying, you know, all over the place. But whenever I arrived somewhere, I felt like I'd cheated, like I'd somehow gotten there in a way that wasn't fully legitimate. And I wanted to experience what it was like to come to borders, to cross countries, to not have to deal with duty-free shops and, you know, baggage handling carousels or any of those things. I wanted to feel in my bones how big the earth was. And if I can add one more thing, you said take you back in a way to 1993-94. Don't forget, this was before iPhones, before we even all had email. The internet had recently been started, you know, it had been launched for the public, but the World Wide Web was just coming into being. And sending dispatches back on the World Wide Web was something completely new that I decided to try to do from this trip.
Right. So that's the other half of the story. You're not only traveling and feeling how big the world is, but you are, in essence, the first travel blogger making the world that much smaller, right?
That's ironic, isn't it? Yeah, on the World Web, I was the first. And it was the big irony of my travel that I set out to really find out how big the world was. And yet I was also tethered to this newly fangled laptop called the Omnibook 300. That if I could find places to plug it in, would let me communicate instantaneously with the home offices of O'Reilly Company in Sebastopol, which was receiving and publishing my dispatches. So I was living both in the present and also, you know, in the future by sending back these dispatches. It was a very crazy-making combination.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you had to have, you had to carry a little machine for that. You also, and this surprised me because I know of very few people who are as outgoing as you are, Jeff. You were nervous about traveling alone. And so you first embarked on a search for the perfect companion. And that went in different ways. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can. And this is before, of course, there was online dating or connections or anything. I put in literally an ad in the weekly paper in the San Francisco Bay Guardian asking for a female travel companion for the trip. And I was clear to state at the beginning, this is not a relationships ad. You know, I'm looking for someone who will travel with me, a woman who has her own agenda. And the reason for this was that from all the travels I'd done previously, it had really become clear that a man and a woman traveling together are sort of the most widely accepted configuration of human beings on planet Earth. A man traveling alone, not so much. A woman traveling alone, yes, but she can also, you know, get into danger and trouble. But a couple traveling together, a man and a woman, they're invited into homes. They're treated like an understandable sort of package of humanity.
Not two men.
Not in 1993, 94.
Yeah, I guess so.
Right now.
Yeah. So you finally, after a couple of misses, you found a lovely traveling companion named Sally, who's a major figure in the book. And I love the fact that in this 30th edition, she has an epilogue on what happened with her life. And you dash it, you go out of your home, you go first to Latin America, then you end up in New York. And then to start the biggest part of your trip, you can't take a cruise ship where you're going. You have to take a freighter. What was traveling by freighter like, and that freighter in particular?
Yeah, the name of that freighter was the Ursus Del Mas. It was a cargo ship that was sailing from Red Hook, Brooklyn to Dakar, Senegal in January of 1994, which was, if any of your listeners, well, including you, are New Yorkers, that was one of the coldest winters on record in New York City. The Hudson River was partially frozen. And into that horrible weather storm, we set off on this fairly large, but not gigantic, cargo ship into the choppy waters of the North Atlantic. And one thing I want to say about riding a cargo ship, I don't know if somebody could replicate the trip today in quite the same way. Because while you can pay to take a cargo ship and be a passenger, the way I did it is you had to be invited by both the owner of the vessel and the captain to be on the ship. There's nothing in it for them except liability. And why anyone would say yes to that today, I absolutely don't know. But back then I was able to secure, through my friend Dwayne Newton, a couple of rooms on this cargo ship. And we had a miserable sail across the North Pacific in the dead of winter.
Yeah, because you were throwing up for the first couple of days and there's literally nothing to do. I think people sometimes think this is a very romantic way to travel, but your book will disabuse them of this unless it's changed in 30 years. Do you think it has?
No. Well, the bigger the ship, you know, the cargo ship we took back home across the Pacific that I took 9 months later was much larger and much more stable and advanced. But yeah, seasickness is a part of almost any ocean voyage for a lot of people. The good news is it's sort of its own inoculation. After you're seasick for about 3 days and get over it, you pretty much have your sea legs. And I never got seasick on any leg of the trip after that.
But this isn't a cruise ship. Well, clearly, there was no entertainment. There was no pool. There was another element of romantic fiction. You had a stowaway. And it was, his story was quite sad. Tell us a little bit about how you discovered that you had a stowaway.
Yeah, we were talking to the captain. Captain Wilgemuth was his name, bless his soul. And he informed us over casual conversation one day at lunch that there was a stowaway on board. And this stunned us. I mean, we'd never even imagined that such a thing was possible. But apparently it's a very common hazard of the shipping industry. And the reason it's a huge hazard is because if a stowaway is found on your ship, you, the captain, are personally responsible for that person's well-being. You must feed them. You must house them. You must give them medical care. On our ship, there was only two stowaways, so it was easy. On some ships, there are as many as 30 or 40. And on some vessels, the captains just throw these people overboard because they don't have the resources to take care of them. Wilgamuth didn't do that to our stowaway, whose name was Fred. He was from Ghana, and he and a friend had been trying to escape to America to make a living as professional soccer players, which was the only skill they learned in their village in Ghana. And Aww. It was poignant. He was just a good-looking, tall Ghana man with dreadlocks and, you know, piercings, and just he just wanted a better life for himself. And he'd taken this huge risk, and now he would have to sail across the Atlantic and then sail all the way back to Ghana and be repatriated at the ship's expense.
Right. And so I guess he got on the ship not realizing that he'd have no food. He'd had to eventually come clean that he was on the ship. And once he came clean, the captain had to repatriate him. He wasn't going to just take him to New York and let him go free, right?
That would have been illegal, yeah. Yeah, it was sad. After 5 days, this refugee ran out of food. He had no toilet. He was trapped in a cargo container, which was sealed from the outside, meaning that somebody at the port had been in cahoots with him. And he had to start pounding on the metal of this cargo container so that somebody would let him out and he could breathe and he could eat something, because he was dying in there.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. It was a horrifying part of the book. So after this long sea voyage, incredible seasickness, even more incredible boredom at sea, because there's really nothing to do, you arrive in Africa. You go to Senegal first. You do what you must do in Senegal. You go out and you go dancing. That just sounded like an extraordinary concert with one of the big top names in Senegalese music.
Yes.
Yeah. And then from there, you have to figure out how you're going to get across the Sahara. And here starts to me the real meat of the book, because so much of the book is about the fact that we live in a world of borders.
Yes.
And that was the big monkey on your back, that you would come and wouldn't be able to cross different borders, that there was always a different story just about getting past this invisible line in the sand in the Sahara.
Literally, yes.
So you ended up going. So before we get to that, I do want to talk about, you talk about going to an area, and I hope the Dogon country or Dogon?
Dogon in Mali, the Dogon country, yes.
So that was before you had the border issues. And that sounded like an extraordinary experience. Is that a main touristic activity, or is that something that very few people get to do? And tell our listeners a little bit about the Dogon country.
Well, it's an ancient civilization that built their homes into the rock and sandstone of this area in eastern Mali. It is a tourist destination for the very few tourists who manage to get to that part of Mali. It's spectacularly interesting. There are really fascinating murals on some of the walls that remind me of the things you will see in Aboriginal Australia. There's still chieftains there. There's still the Dogon inhabitants. But what sort of amazed us the most was their astonishing mythology, which was all based around the idea of this secondary star orbiting the star Sirius in the sky. And when you look at Sirius through even one of the best telescopes, you can't tell that there are two stars there. But in fact, it was found that it is a double planet. And the timing of the Dogon rituals, once every, I think it's 60.2 years, exactly is timed to the orbit of those two stars around each other. So it was one of these incredibly mysterious, weird things that we discovered about these indigenous people. They had a kind of inexplicable wisdom about certain things that we had no idea where it came from. And on the other hand, I gave our guide, I can't remember his name right now, but I gave him my binoculars because he'd never seen the moon before magnified. And I'll never forget where he just, you know, lay down on his back, looked at the moon through the binoculars and went, you know, this just changed my life. To see the moon as a ball in the sky was an experience that he'd never had before, even though that whole tradition around astronomy had been going on for thousands of years.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really beautiful. In fact, you have a part later in the book where you talk about, I think it was Galileo who said, or somebody said, that the invention of glasses probably led to the Renaissance. Why is that? Do you remember?
Of course, that was my old friend and dear friend for many years, the late Arthur C. Clarke, the science luminary and the who came up with the idea of the communication satellite in geosynchronous orbit. Clark speculated, and he had a wonderful line. He said, I don't know if this is a new theory or if it has already been disproven, but his idea was that When eyeglasses were invented, it allowed people to continue their work into their more mature years. So that, can you imagine if you had to stop, you couldn't read anymore after the age of 35, you couldn't do any work with your hands after the age of 30, or say your eyes were never good. The invention of eyeglasses doubled or tripled the productive life of most people throughout Europe, you know, in the whole Renaissance era, and probably brought out the Renaissance itself, according to Clark. I think it was in Florence that I wrote that line from him. And it's always fascinated me that it might be true.
Yeah, and he also talks about telescopes, which is what made me think of that when you showed this guide, the moon. So you go from Mali to, and I love this about the book, not every place is great.
No.
Not every place do you like going through. And I will never, ever go to Mauritania, I think, after reading your description. Mm-hmm. Because a shocking thing is still going on in Mauritania. And I wonder if it is today. But what did you find in Mauritania?
Well, for the first time in my life in Mauritania, I saw human slaves. I'm not talking about sexually trafficked girls, because I have seen those sorts of slaves throughout Asia, unfortunately. I'm talking about adult men and women, Black men and women, who were in the service of families as unpaid slaves. And slaves were still being bought and sold in Mauritania when I was there, even though the practice had been officially outlawed in the 80s. A lot of these individuals had stayed with these families because they had nowhere else to go, of course. And the practice, I don't know, frankly, if it's still ongoing at all. I'm almost 100% sure it must be privately, you know, under the radar. But I don't know if I could find any clear evidence like I did during that travel of human slavery in the households of Mauritanian. It shocked me. And I met a slave trader. I had never thought in my lifetime I would meet someone who traded in human slaves, but he was very proud of his occupation. And it was a real shock to have lunch with this man in this family's compound.
Yeah. And it obviously it's shocking to see slaves. It's shocking to be in the presence of that kind of inhumanity. But also it seems to have or at least 30 years ago, it tainted the culture. People did not treat each other well. There was kind of a corrosive ugliness that you described about Mauritania.
I disliked Mauritania intensely. And I don't like talking about it very much because I don't like disliking places. I can usually find the good in many places. And there are some physically beautiful places in Mauritania. I'm sure there'll be travelers who will take me to task on this. But I saw some things there that I would never want to encounter again in terms of poverty and deprivation, and as I just mentioned, human slavery. So I was very glad to get out of there, even though the trip out of there was extremely fraught.
Yeah. Well, you went with an overland adventure tour company. They happened to be making the trip and you were able to hop on the bus, but just getting through the Sahara Desert, that's when you started running into...
That's the longest stretch of mines on planet Earth. Is the 1,700-mile route along the Western Sahara from Mauritania to Morocco. And we had to traverse that route in the sand under which there were buried mines, navigating by a map written on a napkin that our group had paid $2,000 for in Nouadhibou, Mauritania. So it was a very anxious crossing.
Yeah. Yeah, and that comes to the fore in the book. And then you get to Turkey, and it's like the heavens have opened, the streets are filled with oranges. I love that description you say. I think it was Sally who says, you know, you're in a very rich place when there are oranges on public streets and trees. Anybody can reach up and grab a delicious orange.
Absolutely true. You know, I've been in a lot of countries where the trees have been picked clean of the even the unripe fruits. But Morocco was just blooming with oranges while we were there. And it just seeing trees full of ripe oranges immediately lifts your spirits anyway. But then there were the olives and the souks and the mosques and all these beautiful sights in Morocco. It was a breath of fresh air, believe me, after Mauritania.
Yeah, and I think I said Turkey, so apologies, Morocco. And in Morocco, you had the courage, I don't know if I would, to seek out one of the great literary heroes of the 20th century, the fabulous novelist Paul Bowles. And you had, I think, a very, very meaningful time with him. What was it like to meet one of your heroes, and how did you navigate that?
That was really one of the high points of the trip for me, and a trip with many, many highlights and epiphanies. That was really near the top. I had just gone into the Moroccan tourist office and said I wanted to meet Paul Bowles, and everyone just laughed at me. I guess that he had become a tourist attraction himself and was, you know, quite old, in his 80s, and very reclusive. And a voice piped up from the back of the room, and this tall man in a kaftan said, "I know Paul Bowles. I'll take you to his house." And I said, "Oh, okay. Strange travel suggestions are my specialty." So I hopped in the cab with him. He brought me to the building. He told me which apartment it was. And I went up there and knocked on the door. And there was indeed a plaque on the door that said Paul Bowles. And his caretaker, Bowles' caretaker, opened the door, said Bowles is not accepting or seeing any visitors anymore. And I said, "Well, is there any way I can see him?" He said, "No, I'll be happy to convey your greetings to him, but you're not allowed to see him." And I said, "Look, I've come all this way. I haven't taken any airplanes. I've crossed the world by boat and sea. I would love just a minute with Paul Bowles to shake his hand and say thank you for the beautiful books he's written." So the man looked me up and down and he said, "I'll be right back." And he went off to the back of the room and he said, came back again and he said, "Mr. Bowles will give you 5 minutes." And so I went back there and I remember Bowles sitting up in his bed with a smoking joint next to him in the ashtray, looked at me and he said, "Did you come here to see the last great beat writer?" And I said, "Well, no, you were never really a beat writer. You were always much too literary for that." And that key kind of unlocked him. And he patted on the foot of his bed and he said, "Why don't you sit down?" And I spent 3 or 4 hours with him that afternoon. And I would spend most of the next 2 days with him. We actually had matzah and honey together on Passover and toasted to liberation. He was not aware of any Passover traditions. But that first day, it was so funny because after 3 or 4 hours with Bowles, I went back to the street and my cab who had brought me there was still waiting with the meter running.
Wow. So that was an expensive visit, but probably not. It was Morocco. So
whatever I paid the guy, you know,
right.
It was worth twice that.
And I loved what he had to say about being a writer. You talked to him about his circuitous journey there, which I hadn't known. He was actually an acolyte of a major music composer. He was supposed to be a composer. And then he kind of got into writing. And he talks about how writers have to be, what's the word? I'm desperately flipping through your book to see if I can find where this is.
I think, drawing from my own memory, I think he was talking about writers being constantly under threat in some way. And that you had to use words like bullets to sort of fend off the outside world. It was something along those lines. I don't remember every word of it.
Right, right.
Yeah, we spoke a lot about the process of writing, and his views were very different than mine. He saw them as a much more aggressive form of communication than I do. And just to clarify something before, he was an apprentice, mentee of Aaron Copland.
Yes, yes.
He worked with, yes.
That's right, that's right. And he also, like you, was an avid traveler. You talked about how for Bowles, the great motivating force in life had always been travel, and you give him a Yiddish proverb, which I love, which is, "One should live if only to satisfy one's curiosity," which is just great. And also in the course of that, you kind of offhandedly tell him about this crazy experience you had the night before where you were typing on your computer. And just that was so suspicious that in a cafe, I think. What happened?
I was in a cafe bar in Tangier, which is where Bowles lives. And I was writing a dispatch on my little computer they'd given me, which was this fabulous mini laptop in 1993. Called the OmniBook 300. It ran on 4 AA batteries. So I didn't have to worry about always keeping a charge on these long ocean passages. And they saw me sitting in there on this tiny little black computer, typing away with this little mouse sticking out of the side. And I finished my dispatch. I walked out of the bar to go back to my hotel. And two burly men grabbed me by the arms and threw me into the back of a car. And I was shouting for help. I was completely panicked. I had no idea what was going on. And I ended up in the prison in Tangier, and they wanted some assurance that I was not a spy because this seemed like some James Bond device I was using.
Right.
And so what they did is I gave him the number of Don George at the San Francisco Examiner, who I was writing travel dispatches for at the time. And he reassured them that I was a fully credited travel journalist and I was not a spy at all. And they just said, they just looked at me. They said, well, thank you very much. We're very sorry. You may go. You're always welcome in Morocco. And they, the same two burly men threw me back in the back of the car and drove me back to my hotel.
Wow. Yeah. No, crazy. Just typing on a computer was such a weird thing. So you go from Morocco to Turkey, where, and this is this, all right, this was the moment in the book where I wish you had interjected little notes about what's happening there today, because you go deeply into, I think it's Kemalism, which is from Ataturk. Ataturk was the man who kept Turkey as an independent country in the wake of World War I, when a lot of different countries were being carved up. And he not only kept it an independent country, he made it a secular country where people had rights. It was not going to be a theocracy, as so many other places in that region were. And you were there at a time when the people you met were very, very worried that that was going away. And now it has, to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Have you kept in touch with the folks there who were?
You know, ironically, I haven't kept in touch with most of them because they didn't. No one had email addresses back then.
Right.
But one of the main people I met and was involved with there was a very famous artist, the Picasso of Turkey, whose name was Bedri Baykam. He actually went to art school at UC Berkeley, and I spent time with him in Ankara, Turkey, the capital. And he told me about what was happening with the shift from Kemalism to Islamicism. And, you know, ironically, the Islamic party was using the democratic means to return to power, much as autocrats can use the voting process to come into
power. Absolutely.
And he was really worried about what was happening there. A lot of journalists were being killed. The most recent one had been killed only months ago during my visit. And he himself was so worried about being killed that when we got into his car to go back to his apartment, he put the key in the ignition. He said, you can get out now if you want, because I can't give you a guarantee that this car will not blow up. And in some cavalier way that only I could have done at 40 years old, I said, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound. And he started up the car and we drove back to his flat. But he had really alarming tales to tell. And yes, during the 22 years that Erdogan has had power, there's been a continual shift towards Islamicism and the curtailing of, you know, the secular law that Ataturk had put into place. And not just secular law. Ataturk also believed in the complete equality of women.
Right.
And, you know, I don't think he was very forward thinking on LGBT plus themes, but he was into women's, you know, suffrage and rights. And they worshipped him there. They loved him. And now all the work that he built up in the wake of World War I is sort of slowly being eroded by, you know, fundamentalism.
And was this artist eventually killed? I hope not. Do you know that, or you don't know?
He's still alive. Yeah,
He's still alive.
For him, yeah. And I'm gonna write him a letter and invite to send him one of these books. I don't know if he's still living in Turkey, but since he's such a famous artist there, he won't be difficult to track down.
Yeah, no. You really, I mean, that's one of the things that jumps off the page is these portraits you draw of these wonderful people you meet in so many places. And also the book to me became about the different forms that pilgrimage takes. You meet a lot of people who have lots of different ideas. At one point, you're discussing the fact that your brother had committed suicide about a year before you undertook this journey. And somebody said, a man named Thomas, I guess this is when you were in Kathmandu.
In India.
This is in India?
Yes.
Sorry. He says, you quote him, you're feeling very down about that you're doing this when your brother is no longer on earth. And you say, every step I take, it is my mother walking. Everything I see, every bird or flower or tree, I see with my mother's eyes, because this is how she lives, not through my guilt, not through my pain, but through my love.
So Pauline, that's what Thomas says to me.
Yeah.
Those aren't my words.
No, I know. I said, I meant to say that Thomas said that to you. Yeah. Yes.
Thomas's mother had died of a very painful form of bone cancer. And he'd lived for years with a lot of guilt that he couldn't take that on himself. But then he realized that if his mother were alive, she would want herself to live on through him, through her love, through her care, through her sense of humor, through all the things that made her the person he loved so much. And he said, that's how you should look at your brother. Don't feel guilty. Don't feel enraged by what he did. Don't feel like it's something weighing you down. Take on your brother's best qualities and become him. Keep him alive in the world. And somehow, the way he put that to me, in the place that we were both at the time, which was a sort of retreat for a guru named Harilal Punja, I was really open to that suggestion. And it completely lifted my despair. And I felt light pouring into my heart. And from that moment since, 30 years ago, I've thought of my brother that way, and I haven't felt a shred of sorrow or guilt about his death. I feel like I'm carrying on all of his best qualities through my own life.
Yeah. No, I thought that was a very moving part of the book. And then a little later, I don't want to give away what happens, but something bad happens for you as a writer. And another person says to you, well, this is the real pilgrimage. Right. You're supposed to be having bad things happen to you. That's what is supposed to happen to pilgrims, which I'd never heard of that with pilgrimage before. But I guess it is about being stripped down of what you thought you couldn't do without and still going on.
Yeah, some people describe pilgrimage as the act of giving up all expectations. And just being able to just release yourself into the moment because you can't predict what's going to happen. There will be very severe challenges. It's a crucible and you'll be tested. And certainly this trip around the world, which included, of course, India, Nepal, and Tibet, did test me in that very literal way with things that happened to me both physically and materially, you know, in the world.
Yeah. We don't want to give away that some of the things that happened, but before I let you go, because we're running long, you go to India, Nepal, and Tibet. And so, of course, you spend time at some of the world's most famous religious sites. And one of them is the Lhasa Valley. And can you tell us a little bit about that and what you see there, both the good and the bad? Because it's obviously now under Chinese control. This is a part of Tibet that is very, very sacred to the Dalai Lama, to Tibetan Buddhists. So tell us a little bit about the Lhasa Valley, if you would.
The Lhasa Valley was verdant and green and beautiful when I first visited in 1987. When I visited during this round the world trip 7 years later, the Chinese had already made a huge mark in the valley, and they turned the Potala into a museum. They turned one of the Dalai Lama's homes into a petting zoo, the animals he was keeping there. They let people dress up in monk's robes and be photographed, you know, against the backdrop of the Dalai Lama's palace, the Potala, you know, whatever they could do to mock Tibetan tradition or to devalue it. So much building going on there. And I haven't been there since then, 33 years ago. But from all accounts, it's completely unrecognizable as the holy center it once was. And of course, the Dalai Lama now is living in exile in India, as he has been for many, many years, since the 50s. But like the Jewish people, the Tibetan diaspora has affected every part of the world, and people everywhere from San Francisco to, you know, Senegal to Spain have started Buddhist centers and welcomed lamas into their homes because they've been so influenced by these Tibetans that have been moving all over the world to find a new home now that their homeland has been taken away from them.
There was one particular little detail that you talk about how when you go to a Buddhist site, you're supposed to tour it in a clockwise manner. And the guides had been trained to take people away, to take people around the Dalai Lama's former palace counterclockwise, just as a way to insult Tibetan Buddhism. I just thought that was just a stake in the heart to read.
Well, let me just tell you that the Tibetans, having a wonderful sense of humor and sense of, again, rolling with the punches, said, okay, instead of going around to meet, to follow the Buddha, we're coming the other way to meet him.
Wow.
They made a virtue of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's such a fascinating book, taking me to places I've never read about before. And you do it with such joy and such poetry. So once again, it is called The Size of the World, Once Around Without Leaving the Ground by Jeff Greenwald. Jeff, always an honor to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Mutually. Thank you so much, Pauline, for having me on your podcast.
And that is it for this week's show. I thank you so much for listening. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
Luxury flights and hotels can be had for free. The world of points and miles sounds too good to be true, but it's actually real, but only if you know what you're doing.
On Frequent Miler on the Air, Greg and I'm Nick, discuss all the ways to earn points and miles and use them for outsized value.
Join us every Friday for our full episodes and every Tuesday for our quick, single-topic coffee break episodes.
See you there.